Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with John Zogby, who's the president and CEO of Zogby International, a company which has been praised as America's most accurate pollster by leading news publications and which conducts polls in over 62 countries. His recent poll of American soldiers on the ground in Iraq is the first of its kind and gives a unique insight into what the troops are thinking. So we'll be talking to John Zogby in a moment. Then we'll go to New Delhi in India to speak with Ram Subramanian, who's formerly with the Institute for Defense Studies, and he's now a visiting professor at the Center for International Politics and Disarmament at the Jawaharlal Nehru University in New Delhi. And then we'll speak with Christine Fair, who's a senior research associate at the United States Institute of Peace at the Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention, where she specializes in South Asian political and military affairs. Formerly, she was a political science at the RAND Corporation, and her research has been concerned with security competition between India and Pakistan, and Pakistan's internal security and analysis of the causes of terrorism and the U.S. strategic relationship with India and Pakistan. Of course, she's just returned from Pakistan, and the president has just left Pakistan as well, prior to which he was in India. So we'll be covering both the Indian part of President Bush's recent trip and the Pakistan part. I'm now speaking with John Zogby, who is the president and CEO of Zogby International, and he has just completed a poll, the only poll so far, of American soldiers on the ground in Iraq. And John Zogby, the most extraordinary thing about your poll is the number of, or the percentage of troops who want out, who basically, one in five do not want to heed President Bush's call to stay as long as they are needed. And I think four in five who want to get out right away.
Well, first of all, the question that was asked is very important. We didn't ask when they want to leave, because I think the answer would have been yesterday. Mm. The question really more was, when should U.S. troops leave Iraq? And 72% said within the next 12 months. Of that, 29% said they want to leave immediately. They want U.S. troops out of there immediately. It was only 23% who said that they wanted to stay until the job was finished.
And how did you get into the country? This is one of the most dangerous places in the world. Basically, the journalists, many of them, don't leave the green zone because of the very blatant and clear risks to their lives. So, how were you able to conduct the polls? I guess were you in these secure areas where the troops are?
Ian, I have been 100% willing to discuss all the details of the methodology off the record with journalists. On the record and certainly on radio talk, I really can't do that for security reasons, not even suggesting where who conducted the poll, because those were the agreements that I had with people on the ground. Suffice it to say that there were four distinct significant clusters of U.S. troops representative of the American military presence as a whole, four different locations, and that the poll takers we used were civilian employees with access, direct access to these soldiers.
And was this poll taken prior to the recent portent of a civil war breaking out with the blowing up of the mosque in Samarra?
Yes. The poll began the first week of January, January 6th, and was conducted through February 6th and 7th. So it was well before the bombing of the Shiite mosque and the most recent development, as you suggest, that pretend civil war.
And what is one of the extraordinary statistics in your poll that I find puzzling is you say that almost 90% of the soldiers that were polled think that the war in Iraq is in retaliation for Saddam's role in 9/11. Now, are they saying that they believe that Saddam was behind 9/11, or that the president sent them to Iraq because he believed Saddam was behind 9/11?
That's a very, very good question. And if I can just back up a few steps, we asked them, first of all, if they felt the mission was clear in Iraq, and if we're going into Iraq, 42% said that the mission was either somewhat unclear or very unclear. to them. 58%, on the other hand, said that it was very or somewhat clear. And there was a real significant difference, not surprisingly, between Marines and Army on one hand, full-time careerists, versus National Guard and Reserve on the other hand. But then we then took several statements that have been suggested to be the main or major mission, and this was one of them, and this one was the one that came out first place. 85%, in fact, said that it was the main or major mission. And it suggested to me that it was really a combination of this, of both suggestions that you made. It sounded like some actually believed that that was the mission, and it sounded like to others that was the reason that they were told. And it was that mission, that statement, that seemed to settle much more on the National Guard and the Reserve, the part-time military.
And in terms of the insurgency, apparently what you found out is that most of the troops believe that the Iraqi insurgents are homegrown, and they also, they don't blame the Iraqi public for the insurgents' attacks.
That was very intriguing, because on one hand, you got a sense that they may be misinformed, but on the other hand, there was some clarity there that they did not believe that this was Al-Qaeda based. They didn't believe that by stopping foreign imports or Al-Qaeda that the insurgency would stop, that they in fact believed that this was homegrown, that it was a legitimate, to use the terminology, insurgency. And at the same time, they felt that, again, to going after the relatively small number of outside terrorists would not stop this insurgency.
And when you say you find out that 58% of the troops polled in Iraq say the mission is clear and 42% say the U.S. role is hazy, mm-hmm. What is the mission? Because the president himself has changed his mind about what the mission is and has never been exactly clear. So can you, in a very short sentence, say what the mission is or what they think the mission is, the 58% who believe it's clear?
You know, we're in a situation where it's late Vietnam, Ian. The mission keeps changing, and that's when you sense that a war is really in trouble, when the mission keeps changing. At this point in time, in Vietnam, the mission was boiled down to, what do we say to the parents of the loved ones who were already killed? It was long gone that it was a war to stop communism or whatever. It became intensely personal. So we're at the stage right now, I think, where, yeah, there is confusion as to why we're still there. The troops were very clear that this war had nothing to do with spreading democracy. Only 23% said that it had anything to do with creating a model for democracy. Even fewer said that the infrastructure or that the needs of the Iraqi people were being taken care of any better than before.
And do any of the troops or the people that you polled in Iraq, are they aware of polls taken here in the United States that indicate the majority of Americans, a growing majority of Americans, oppose the war in Iraq and would like the troops withdrawn?
They are, and when we asked about how they would characterize Americans who oppose the war and want the troops home, the largest single answer, the plurality, said that it was that those Americans should be characterized as unpatriotic, which on the surface is a curious response, but when you probe a little more deeply, what you find is that their assessment of Americans is coming predominantly from the Marines and the Army. In other words, the full-time professional Army and Marines and the careerists.
As opposed to the National Guard people?
As opposed to the National Guard people.
And they make up about 40%?
40%, yeah. 25% of our sample were Army and 40% 40% were Army, 25% were Marines. I'm sorry.
And another interesting finding you have in your poll, John Zogby, is that the majority of the troops polled opposed the use of harsh prisoner interrogation. That seems to sort of almost conflict with the White House, and particularly Vice President Cheney's insistence that they keep that option open.
One of the reasons that I trust the results of the poll is that the responses were all over the place. When I start to see knee-jerk reactions going all down one end and overwhelming on one end, then I start to question how legitimate the survey was. But here we had nuances, we had differences, and clearly it was a majority overall, and then most especially of National Guard and Reserves who were opposed to the tough types of interrogations utilized, say, at Abu Ghraib.
Well, just in closing then, John Zogby, the president's numbers are variously reported at 38 and down as low as 34. Uh-huh. Where do you put the president's favorability ratings?
I have mine out coming out tomorrow. As of Friday evening, the president was at 38%.
38%.
Mm-hmm.
And that's down...
That's down. When he's down into the 30s, he not only is doing poorly among Democrats and independents, but he's losing a chunk of his own base. And then I, too, have him at 30% in terms of a rating on handling Iraq.
And the vice president?
My last poll had the vice president at 18.
And that was that before the shooting?
That was after the shooting.
I see. Perhaps he's crept up a little bit, but he's still in an unenviable position. I thank you so much for joining us in Los Angeles, John Zogby.
It's good to talk to you. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with John Zogby, who is one of the nation's leading pollsters, and he polls his company, Zogby International, conducts polls in 62 countries, over 62 countries, and his recent poll of the American soldiers on the ground in Iraq is the first of its kind, and it gives us, as you've noticed, a unique insight into what the troops are thinking. And let's now turn to the subject of India. And the president's trip to India, which was preceded by a brief stopover in Afghanistan that was unannounced, and then he went on to India for a state visit that had been in preparation for some time. And then he went to Pakistan briefly and is on his way back. And let's now go to the subject of an Indian perspective on President Bush's trip, particularly the nuclear deal that was made, and we'll go to New Delhi. I'm speaking with Ram Subramanian, who was formerly with the Institute of Defense Studies and is now a visiting professor at the Center for International Politics and Disarmament at the Jawaharlal Nehru University. And obviously this trip this week of the president to India was very much a victory for the Indian side, at least. There's a lot of complaints here in the press in the United States that, in effect, the president is rewarding India for bad behavior. So how is it playing domestically?
I don't think he's rewarding for bad behavior. On the contrary, he's rewarding for responsible behavior, unlike some other states which have engaged openly in proliferation, like... China proliferated in Iran in 1992 after Li Peng's visit and paved the way for the AQ Khan network, as has been pointed out by Kenneth R. Timmerman, former CIA official, in his book Countdown to Crisis, published in 2004. Now, I don't think it's rewarding India at all for bad behavior. India is the most responsible country as far as non-proliferation is concerned, although we hadn't signed that treaty because of its discriminatory status.
Well, that was the general impression was that we're trying to restrain North Korea and Iran. And
yeah, but North Korea and Iran have signed the non-proliferation treaty, and in spite of that, they have been accused of trying to build nuclear weapons. I mean, that's a completely different ballgame.
Sure.
Here it is, the so-called Ayatollahs or theologians of non-proliferation who have traditionally maintained this propaganda that, India is being rewarded. It's completely way off the mark, you know.
Right.
That's a completely different case. The additional protocols and the safeguarding method, they are subject to Iran and North Korea is quite different. I mean, there are three states outside the non-proliferation treaty that reside in the fire break. That's India, Pakistan, and Israel. And Israel has no peaceful nuclear activity, so separation is not an issue. Pakistan has indulged in proliferation networks, as has been alleged. Therefore, there is a specific case of India. And I don't think it's rewarding in any way. It's just an acknowledgement of the reality of the enormous ranges of economic relationships that is going to take place.
And
the fact that India has... Yeah.
Sorry, and the fact that what?
And it's back of mind is the commitment to democracies, yeah? The successful experiment of a very large... democracy.
And a growing middle class that will equal the entire population of the United States quite soon.
Yeah.
And obviously...
Can you speak a little louder?
I will speak a little louder, yes. Obviously,
yeah.
The subtext to this agreement seems to me to be that the American commercial nuclear industry sees India as a huge market because of global warming.
In 30 years since the United States engaged in export of nuclear, and we have had a history of Indo-US nuclear cooperation. The first research reactor was provided in 1960, the Apsara, and it was also given to Pakistan, one research reactor under the Atoms for Peace program. The Tarapur agreement then got into trouble because the U.S. passed a domestic legislation under Jimmy Carter, after the Non-Proliferation Act, and that is, annulling international obligations. But in spite of that, President Carter used his executive privilege and paved the way for enriched uranium for Tarapur reactor. So here it's a question of basically what the nuclear weapon states have been doing. I mean, separating the civil from the nuclear. China hasn't done it. U.S. had put 235 civilian nuclear reactors for international safeguard, but only 35 have really been assessed. Now, IAEA becomes an actor, and it's a trilateral arrangement. So it's U.S. nuclear industry, definitely, and not only U.S., all other major exporters like France, Russia, and perhaps Canada.
Well, wasn't there a deal just done with France before President Bush's visit?
Well, the Chirac visit, yes, certainly, there's no deal because the NSG consists of 41 countries today. It started with 7 in November 74 as a follow-up to the Indian explosion of a nuclear device. It was that time United States, Japan, UK, Germany, Italy, and Canada. But now it has become a much more broad-based, with Russia also was there in the Magnificent Seven. Now China has also joined as a nuclear weapon state. The moot point is the Chinese have initially recognized this fact, and now they are expressing reservations of non-proliferation, which is meaningless.
So tell me about Ram Subramanian. Tell me about the deal itself, because apparently...
The deal itself has been hammered out after the Manmohan Singh Bush agreement of July 18, 2005, which talked about reciprocation. And as it has been stated at that time, that India would be considered as an advanced nuclear state with responsible characteristics. And you cannot formalize under the aegis of NPT nuclear weapon status, because that is accorded only to the permanent five of the UN Security Council, because they had all detonated nuclear devices before January 1st, 1967. And therefore, nuclear non-proliferation treaty has divided into five accidentally that have nuclear weapons, and they can continue to retain it and still be members of NPT. Now, this deal itself is significant because it recognizes that by separating out, 60% of the facilities are being put under IAEA safeguard. 40% will be left as military. That means if the strategic needs of India arise, especially with regard to providing nuclear deterrence against China, you require fissile material. And hence, Breeder is about a decade away, is left free. And most important for India was the three-phase program envisioned by Homi Bhabha as early as 1944. So first going into natural uranium heavy water reactors, the CANDU from Canada, and the Atoms for Peace program. Then deriving the plutonium and putting it in the breeder. And third stage is largest reserves of thorium in the sands of Kerala. They'll be converted into uranium-233 in a self-sustaining nuclear cycle known as thermal breeder. Now that is still about two decades away, thorium thermal breeder. And that leaves open, so the significance of the is 60% of the facility, like the nuclear weapon state, has been put under safeguard.
So Ram Subramanian, the 60% of the reactors, that the civilian reactors that presumably the United States commercial nuclear companies would like to build in India because of India's... The United States commercial nuclear industry would like to get into India because there's an assumption that India will have tremendous demand for energy.
Yeah, a Westinghouse, and UK has bought into it, and the UK is also a member of the Nuclear Suppliers Group.
Right.
And the American nuclear industry would naturally like to sell reactors after Three Mile Island. The United States has not really closed down the Kings River breeder and so on. The United States is interested in selling light water reactors, which is what Tarapur is, light water enriched uranium. The issue is perpetuity in regard to contract of supplies of uranium and perpetuity on safeguards. But our understanding is if the contract on sale of uranium collapses, the safeguards also collapse.
And so what about the fuel rods, though? What about
the fuel rods will not be reprocessed. They'll be sent back. Like the Tarapur Agreement also has a joint determination that, as far as the civilian things are concerned, they're under IAEA safeguards anyway. So there's no sense in taking the fuel rods and reprocessing them to recover plutonium. But we're definitely keeping out some of the reactors out of the civilian, like the two indigenously built Tarapur. The rest, all that will be imported, will be under IAEA safeguard. So the spent fuel will no longer be entitled for reprocessing. Reprocessing will be done as far as the military reactors are concerned to put it into the breeder and double the plutonium and then use the plutonium to convert fertile thorium-232 into uranium-233 and then burn it as fuel in thermal breeder.
And how...
So those spent fuel rods is our freedom to reprocess, not the ones under safeguard.
And how many civilian nuclear reactors do you think India will need to meet its growing energy demands for electricity?
Our energy requirement is 20,000 megawatts and also uranium for it. That is the motivation from the Indian side. For the American side, if their civilian nuclear industry would like to get into export, you know?
Right.
So there requires an Export Administration Act, also requires some amendments because of the requirements of the U.S. Congress. And how many reactors we'll require at least 10 and light water reactors over the next decade to increase our present generation capacity from 2 gigawatts to 20 gigawatts. Giga means 1,000, essentially billion watts of electricity. So at the least required for 10 reactors. It need not necessarily come from U.S. It could come from the giant atomic power plants of Russia. We have two of them. They're under IAEA safeguards anyway. And the French.
So I understand that the light water reactor is basically 1950s technology. Isn't there... Who has the best, most modern, safest nuclear technology on the commercial market today?
Who has the best? I would say the French and the Russians, because American reactor technology is pretty old and they haven't brought built any new reactors over the last 30 years since Three-Mile Island happened. But this may also enable the Canadians to come back. They pulled out in 74 after our nuclear explosion, and we have done a lot of engineering marvels in the CANDU reactors, and the Canadians are quite interested in our enormous advances we have done in small and medium power reactors. So for the Chalk River facilities of the Atomic Energy Canada Limited in Ontario are quite keen to get into some of the engineering marvels that we have done. So many of the reactors, light water reactors, the advantage is they can be built quicker in about 5 years. So as far as safety record is concerned, certainly the French and the Russians have a very good safety record.
But the CANDU reactor, the Canadian reactor, which I believe was the reactor that that India used to develop its nuclear weapons, isn't it the most vulnerable to proliferation because it doesn't require enriched uranium?
The CANDU that you are thinking of is that Cyrus. It's very old. In 5 years, it has been declared it'll be put out of action or decommissioned, you know. It's a pretty old reactor. 1960, it went critical.
Right. But the point I'm making, the point I'm trying to make is that the CANDU is a reactor that doesn't require enriched uranium, isn't it?
No, CANDU doesn't require enriched uranium, but light water reactors, as I mentioned to you, take shorter time to build.
Right.
So there's an interest in importing light water reactors.
Right. But the CANDU is considered the most vulnerable in terms of proliferation, isn't it?
No. Actually, the CANDU is no more proliferation resistant than light water because both produce plutonium.
I see.
Actually, the breeder is Alvin Weinberg at Oak Ridge National Lab in Tennessee always used to say that the molten salt breeder reactor using thorium was very proliferation resistant because the doubling time is very large, 30 years.
I see.
So it would be very unlikely to be diverted. And CANDU is no more proliferation prone than a light water reactor.
Well, just in closing, Ram Subramanian, do you think that given that the United States has the most old and antiquated civilian nuclear technology, and you said the French and the Russians have better modern and safer reactors, how many of these 10 that you need do you think the United States is going to get to build?
United States is going to get to export. It will depend on the status of the Westinghouse reactors, no? But there are many other ancillaries involved, spare parts, turbines. Not just going to be just reactor that's involved, and there are a lot of dual-use technology and so on that will come in, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so we can't just see it in terms of the reactor sales alone. And with growing nuclear power, because U.S. itself is now realizing the rising cost of oil, the importance of nuclear energy. And second important thing is the U.S. interest and India's interest in the international thermonuclear energy. The fusion has to be collaborative. You know, at Cadarache, France, there's the international thermonuclear energy experiment. And the U.S. has been quite positive with France in getting India aboard with South Korea, Japan, France, Canada, and so on. It's a very important development. We must think in the long term of fusion and phase four generation reactors, which have a lot of active passive safety systems, which are much safer. So the United States nuclear industry would have definitely a major role, not only in fusion, but also in, not only in fission, but fusion.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Ram Subramanian.
Wonderful. It's a pleasure.
And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Ram Subramanian, who is in New Delhi, India. He's formerly with the Institute for Defense Studies, and he's now a visiting professor at the Center for International Politics and Disarmament at the Jawaharlal Nehru University in New Delhi. I'm now speaking with Dr. Chris Fair, who's a senior research associate at the United States Institute for Peace's Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention. She specializes in South Asian political and military affairs, and much of her research has been concerned with security competition between India and Pakistan, Pakistan's internal security analyses of the causes of terrorism, and the U.S. strategic relationship with India and Pakistan. And she has just returned from Pakistan. And Chris Fair, just to touch on the Indian situation a little longer here. I think it was George Perkovich described President Bush's trip to India not so much as a negotiation, but as Santa Claus giving away gifts.
Well, George Perkovich, I would have to say that most people in the South Asia policy analytical community has been supportive of this deal. Ashley Tellis, of course, is probably the architect of it. But George Perkovich has actually been one of the lone voices that's been fairly critical of the deal. Of course, he's not alone, but he is certainly very prominent, given that, you know, he authored one of the most authoritative books on the India nuclear program.
And I take it that you and other scholars of this area for the last few years have been focusing on preventing a nuclear war between India and Pakistan. I mean, there's an impression that things got fairly tense for the first, at least the first part of the Bush administration.
Well, I think I would characterize it somewhat differently. My view of U.S. government involvement in this area has really been one of crisis management. There have actually been no concerted efforts on the part of the United States government to deal with what is at the core of this security competition, and that's the Kashmir dispute. The longstanding position of the United States government, of course, is that this is a bilateral dispute that needs to be resolved by both India and Pakistan, although I understand that President Bush did recently elaborate on that position and also included in it some space for the Kashmiris themselves, who are often overlooked. But this is really the fundamentals of the conflict really have not been addressed in any serious way by the U.S. government, or for that matter, by any other government.
So there hasn't been a sea change then from crisis management to engagement?
No. I mean, you will hear episodically U.S. officials suggesting that there might be some interest in moving in that direction. So, for example, several years ago, Colin Powell, then Secretary of State, made some noise in that direction, and he was very quickly rebuffed by the Indians. I mean, the Indians' position is really one of the United States and no one else should interfere, except to the extent that U.S. involvement can pressurize Pakistan to do what India finds to be desirable. But India does not welcome an internationalization of that dispute unless it specifically serves its interest. Now, Pakistan, on the other hand, welcomes any internationalization of the dispute. So therein lies an asymmetry in how both actors view the role of the United States and others in trying to get some movement towards resolving the fundamental issue, which is the disputed disposition of Kashmir.
Well, our previous guest in New Delhi, Ram Subramanian, almost suggested, he didn't say this, but he felt that this was a great opportunity for the American nuclear industry that president. So was the president a salesman for Westinghouse?
Well, I think there is an element of truth to it. One of the things that I've noticed, and I think a lot of people who've been watching this have noticed, one of the drivers of this Indo-U.S. relationship has been the Indian-American community and I think also commercial interests. And there are times when the commercial interests in the Indo-American community have overlapped. So, for example, some of these entities are, in fact, Indian-American-owned entities. So there's an element to which he's true. If you talk to anyone in Congress who has to deal with these dual-use issues and deal with licensing, they're much more circumspect because, you know, from their point of view, high technology and access to it is always the bone that's tossed out in diplomatic circles. But, you know, there's also risks that go with providing a country such access to high technology and dual-use technologies as well. So there's a crux to it. There's an element of truth to what he said, but I think the deal is much more nuanced. Like, for example, one of the strongest arguments for the deal, you know, quite apart from the business angle, which I don't think anyone would deny, is that for the first time, you know, India is basically agreeing to put some of its civilian infrastructure under international safeguards. Some people would even argue that this is a path of getting the Indians to cap you know, their CISL material. Now, I understand that there have been some retrenchment from some of the specifications of the deal that may make that not as realistic as perhaps originally had hoped for. But nonetheless, there are several views from which this deal can be viewed, and I think it can be summed up in the following way, that it's very good for Indo-U.S. relations, and yet it can also be very troubling from the point of view of non-proliferation.
But just in terms of the nuclear weapons program on both India and Pakistan, my understanding is, at least as far as the CIA knows, that there's plenty of fissile material in both countries, but there are some questions about the Indian nuclear weapons themselves, whether they're as efficient and effective as the Chinese designs that the Pakistans have.
Well, this is not an area of my core expertise, and I'm not going to be able to talk about the differential advantages and disadvantages of the hardware of the different programs. I do know that a couple years ago, General Zinni made a number, in fact, I think it was in 2002, at the height of the 01-02 crisis, you know, General Zinni made comments that suggested that in his view, Pakistan's arsenal was both qualitatively and quantitatively superior to that of India. But that was, of course, a number of years ago now. And as I said, this is not, you know, an area where I don't feel comfortable speculating about these issues.
Well, let's then talk about what was pretty evident on the television screens. You may have missed it because you were coming back from Pakistan, but there was no question that in India there were major demonstrations, but they were largely led by the Hindu Muslim population, and by the communists, who are actually a part of the governing coalition. And I believe that one of the reasons the president didn't speak at the Red Fort was that it was in a Muslim neighborhood. So
it's Old Delhi.
Yeah. So what does that say about our relationship with the Muslim world?
Well, I think there are a couple of different things. We have a relationship with India, with this particular government in India that was forged by its predecessor government, the BJP. And
which is a right-wing Hindu nationalist government.
I think many people would agree with that characterization. But I think that what the protests really demonstrate is that, I mean, as you may have noticed, the last several years, everyone has sort of talked about, I think without a lot of empirical evidence, I might add, about the relative quiescence of Indian Muslims. And this has been something that's been lauded in op-ed pieces, it's been lauded in policy papers and so forth. So what I find really notable about the primarily Muslim demonstrations is that they are so large and that they are so vocal. And that they've happened in a country, India, where you really haven't seen since, you know, 9/11, this kind of mobilization. So that struck, the very fact that they were happening at all and on this scale struck me as really important. And I would actually say, you know, having spent nearly 2.5 to 3 weeks in Pakistan, the demonstrations in India were really quite large, larger than most of the demonstrations that I saw in Pakistan, maybe with the exception of those that happened in Karachi. So they were certainly notable. But one of the things I would like to emphasize about some of these demonstrations, because I unfortunately was there in Pakistan during many of these demonstrations, they are nominally about the cartoons. But once the things get rolling, very quickly they stop being about the cartoons, and they become a forum to talk about things that are much larger in perspective. So, for example, in Pakistan, the cartoon flavor was just a patina. It was really a forum to talk about concerns about the Bush-Musharraf relationship, Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, things of that nature. Now, in India, I'm not particularly privy to how those, I mean, I haven't seen any press coverage of what was actually said at those demonstrations. But, you know, obviously they were very much anti-Bush in tone. And I think it does reflect, it is symptomatic of the fact the U.S. has a really big problem on its hands in terms of its relationship with the Muslim world. And even though the U.S. really had nothing to do with the cartoons, I was really struck to hear the extent to which the United States has actually been blamed as being the so-called hidden hand behind the cartoons. So this has been a very interesting time to be watching domestic mobilization in South Asia.
Well, last week, Dr. Farah, I had Bob Baer on, the CIA officer that ran the operation in Iraq between after the Gulf War up to the present war, and then he's written a couple of books, and the movie Syriana is the George Clooney character is based on Baer, and you know he's basically a specialist on Iraq, where he speaks Arabic, etc. But just as an aside, he said, well, you know, we're talking about the fact that he believes that we've already lost Iraq and we're kind of whistling past the graveyard and eventually we're going to get driven out of there, but he, as an aside, he said, well, we've also lost Pakistan. So, I mean, is that, do you get any impression that we've lost, maybe we've lost the street, but what's your reading on?
My take has been that we never had Pakistan. And if you listen to the way in which, I mean, for example, if you listen to Bush's speech at the Asia Society in advance of his trip, and if you look at the comments he's made during his time in Delhi and in Islamabad, you notice a very distinctive difference in tone. He talks about India in terms of civilizational language. He talks about India's democracy, its vibrant democracy, its rich civilizational heritage. He talks about its people and its diversity and its multi-religious and multi-ethnic dimensions.
And its growing middle class, too.
And, of course, the commercial. I mean, we would expect that from you know, Bush. This has been one of the drivers of the Indo-U.S. relationship has been the commercial underpinnings. When he talks about Pakistan, he has nothing to say about the country and its people. He talks about Musharraf and his attributes. He's a brave man. He's a courageous man. He's in this because Al-Qaeda wants to kill him, too. He has nothing to say about Pakistan in Pakistanis. And this disjunction has been there from the get-go. And one of the things that really strike me is that on the Pakistani side, you have a core of what I would call armed forces apologists who say, oh, the Pakistan Armed Forces is the only institution capable of holding this country together. And those are the people that interact with U.S. policymakers. So many people within the United States can sleep very easily at night knowing that we can promote democracy everywhere else, at least in name, but still prop up what is essentially a military dictatorship in Pakistan. And no one sees this as problematic. Yet, when you go to Pakistan, and I don't care whether I'm talking to a very sophisticated government official, a political analyst, or even if it's my rickshaw driver, there is broad-based consensus that this is horrible, that the United States cannot both be promoting democracy while basically doing everything to undermine democracy in Pakistan. And what I'm struck by is that the Islamists themselves are the only political voice that can aggregate this interest. And so it's the Islamists that are making constitutional arguments and democratic arguments. And so this is very ironic indeed. And of course, it is left to them to make these arguments because Musharraf has done everything he can to marginalize and to delegitimize and to render functionless the two mainstream parties. So one of the things that has evolved in my thinking over the last several years is that I think when and if this relationship dissolves, Pakistan is going to be left with far fewer democratic institutions, capabilities, than it had before the U.S. became involved in this region. So this is yet another case, I think, where U.S. short-term interest, i.e. the war on terrorism, mitigates against our long-term interest, which is a stable, democratic country of Pakistan, which is at peace with itself and at peace with its neighbors.
Well, doesn't that also indicate, Dr. Fair, that the military are, in effect, the worst people to be running that country? Because they've already had a number of wars against India, all of which they were resoundingly defeated in. And it would seem that if you have a military government, the military, by definition, would want to justify their existence. And the only way to justify their existence is to keep the tensions going with India, rather than just make a quantum change in the relationship and, you know, call it quits, demilitarize, and start trading.
Well, there is this very interesting catch-22 that Pakistan finds itself in. One, a civilian leader may be in a position to take the decisions to normalize relations with India, normalize relations with Afghanistan. But in doing so, that individual would have supreme knowledge that his, most likely his, or possibly her, tenure would thereafter end. And so, in other words, you need a leader that has a supreme sense of self-sacrifice, that he or she could take a decision that would be very negative for their own personal outcomes, but would be very good with the nation. In the case of the Pakistan Army, and I think to a great extent for the kinds of reasons that you elaborated, they're the ones that could take this kind of decision and write it out, if you will. Because, of course, they're not sitting there at the behest of the people, right? But what makes it impossible for the Army to do that is precisely that which you noted, that such a decision would be good for the country and its destiny, but in terms of the corporate Army interests, it would be very negative. So you have this situation where neither civilian nor military leader will really be in a position to make the kinds of decisions on its own that could bring peace to the region. And unfortunately, and I'm not sure if other analysts would agree with me, but this is my opinion nonetheless, that is why the United States and the international community needs to be much more active, because neither India nor Pakistan on its own has an incentive structure which promotes them to take steps that are meaningfully in the direction of normalization.
And Christy Fair, you mentioned Pakistan's role with Afghanistan. A while back, I spoke with Anonymous, Mike Scheuer from the CIA, and he basically felt that we were doomed in Pakistan. In Afghanistan. That not so long ago, after 9/11, the United States were in Pakistan hunting down and killing the Taliban, and now the Taliban are hunting down and killing us. So there has been a change there. But he felt that we were doomed in Afghanistan for strategic reasons and for strategic blindness. He felt that we don't give the Pakistanis any incentive but to be spoilers, because we're throwing our lot in with the Northern Alliance, with the Russians, and with the Indians, who are sort of making mischief in Afghanistan. So,
well, I think that analysis was probably more true in the early part of the conflict, no later. Since the elections, the ruling coalition It's become much more diverse, and the dominance of the Northern Alliance has become far less obvious. But I think, however, there's a much more fundamental problem with the U.S.-Pakistan relationship with a reference to Afghanistan, and that is literally the terms of the engagement and how the engagement is described. If you look at the way the Pakistan media talks about this, they will always talk about it in the context of Pakistan doing the United States a favor. Right? And therefore, when they don't get a deal like the Indians got, as one of the Pakistani papers called it, Bush didn't even give Musharraf a lollipop. It creates a sense of resentment among the Pakistani populace that Musharraf is selling out his sovereignty in the service of the United States, and he's not getting anything in return that justifies that kind of compromise. Now, the United States has been very acquiescent to letting this description go on without intervention, that in fact Pakistan is doing the U.S. a favor. I think at the level of strategy, this is an enormous mistake. Pakistan's not doing the United States a favor by tracking down al-Qaeda in the federally administered tribal areas, so-called FATA. Pakistan is doing that because it is in Pakistan's interest. And there has been, to date, very little interest in trying to introduce what I would call a more accurate depiction into the way in which this relationship is described. Now, to give further ballast to my point, if you look at areas that are not in Pakistan's interest, you don't see this cooperation. While Bush talked about, and other administration officials have talked about, the 500 or 600 so terrorists that have been apprehended, the very simple fact remains that among them, not a single high-level Taliban operative has been detained by the Pakistanis. There has been no cooperation, except very episodic, fleeting, and temporal, on the Kashmir militancy. And the earthquake of October of 2005, and the very obvious presence of the militant groups, the so-called jihadists in Kashmir delivering that aid, really exposed a lot of the fiction that Musharraf had been spreading. He was very clear that there were no terrorists or no militants or what have you in Kashmir. And then as soon as the earthquake happened, these very same militants found themselves working side by side international aid groups. So if you actually look at the area of overlap, it's Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda only for the most part. And it's not because they're doing us a favor or because we're buying them off, but because it's in Pakistan's own interest to capture these Al-Qaeda operatives. So the issue of attacks being perpetrated from individuals by individuals based in Pakistan operating in Afghanistan, these are what could be called neo-Taliban. And it's not, frankly, in Pakistan's interest to detain those individuals. You know, Pakistan has a paramount interest in retaining what I would call these Pashtun militants to prosecute its interests in Afghanistan to, as you noted, counter the Indian influence. The Indians are very active in Afghanistan, but they're also very active in Iran. So this is at the strategic level, you know, how I would characterize the U.S.-Pakistan relationship in these different areas as they pertain to Afghanistan.
Well, apparently, Karzai and General Warnock, when they went to visit Musharraf a couple of weeks ago, took DVDs of evidence of Pakistan's role in supporting Taliban raids across the border.
Right. Well, in the Pakistani circles, that intelligence was summarily rubbished. But the fact of the matter is that I know of no U.S. official with whom I've spoken, and for that matter, even my own Pakistani interlocutors within Pakistan, I don't know anyone who denies that everyone suspects a Pakistani role in these attacks. Now, the question is, what is the nature of this role? Are we talking about frontier constabulary? Are we talking about frontier corps? Are we talking about retired ISI officials? What has been less clear has been the characterization of that role, whether it's a state actor problem, whether it's a non-state actor, or some combination of both. But, of course, Zalmay Khalilzad, if you listen to the things that came out of the embassy when he was there in Kabul, he said things that were, I think, very much indicating that this was a problem that had a Pakistani signature to it. And, of course, those views were strongly rebutted by the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad. But like I said, the folks I know in Pakistan, the folks I know here in D.C., strongly suspect that there is some level of Pakistani support for these activities. And, I'm not a fan of speculating, but it did strike me that the way in which the missile strike on Bajor agency in January of this year, you know, usually when the U.S. has operated in this way, there's usually been some fig leaf given to the Pakistani security forces. This was done without a fig leaf. It was done without apology. And in fact, you know, there was no mention of this during the Bush visit. You know, there has been no apology. There will be no apology. And in fact, Bush administration officials have repeatedly said that if necessary, such operations would be conducted again in the future. So I'm, you know, looking at what I hear in Pakistan, looking at what I see and hear here in the United States, it does seem as if there's a growing exhaustion with this problem. And to be honest, I'm really surprised that Americans, the American citizen, hasn't taken greater alarm at this. Because on the other hand, I think an argument could be made, and there have been some op-eds to this effect, but these op-eds haven't really proliferated, and this idea hasn't really gathered any momentum, that this is supposed to be our important ally in the war on terrorism. Yet an argument could be made that because of this very same ally, American men and women are dying in Afghanistan.
Well, I think you mentioned the raid. I guess that was the raid on that where they tried to get al-Zawahiri, the number two, rather derisively, Hillary Clinton, Senator Clinton, the other day asked rhetorically, "How come we can't capture the tallest man in Afghanistan?" Referring to bin Laden's height. So there is a sense that somebody's not cooperating there or somebody's not being particularly zealous. What's your reading on it? Do you really think that anybody wants to... I mean, I imagine the Bush administration wants to catch bin Laden, but do the Pakistanis really want to?
Well, my position on this has been that Pakistan, with respect to al-Qaeda, has a serious problem and a serious interest in apprehending them. On the issues of the Taliban, there's a lot more ambivalence because, you know, like the Kashmiri militants, Pakistan needs to keep these guys in reserve. Pakistan, while it is in the near term, at least in principle, dedicated to supporting a Karzai regime, in the long term, Pakistan has a number of concerns, namely, you know, as you noted, the Indian involvement, and they're very concerned about a regime in Afghanistan that is much more friendly to Delhi and hostile to Islamabad. And many Afghanistanis, actually, or Afghans, are very much opposed to Pakistan as well. So there is a difference in its commitment to dealing with the Taliban and to al-Qaeda. Now, the problem is that the support base for both of these elements get really mixed up in areas like Fatah. So that's the problem for Pakistan, is that it's very resistant to go after, for example, Pakistanis who are involved in this. The majority of people that you hear about are, in fact, foreigners. They're not Pakistanis. They're Uzbeks. They're Chechens. They're, you know, other Central Asians. So it's not one of, is Pakistan worried about al-Qaeda? Pakistan is worried about al-Qaeda, but it's worried about al-Qaeda in a context when it has other considerations.
Well, you mentioned earlier that the people who are most promoting democracy in Pakistan are the Islamists.
Yes, and I think that's true. Mm. And that's because, unfortunately, and I think this is by design. If Musharraf really at some point felt that the Islamists were getting out of control, I think he feels that he can deal with them. And we saw this, for example, if you compare the procedures for contesting elections in 2002 and in 2005, you saw, I think, the Musharraf government trying to regulate and control those elections. So, for example, in 2002, the madrasa degrees were completely accepted as satisfying the educational requirement to contest an election. And I might add, by comparison, all the religious political figures have madrasa degrees. So most of them were able to satisfy the educational criteria. In contrast, most of the politicians from the mainstream parties did not have a BA, and thus they were not, they were very disadvantaged in terms of getting the numbers of people qualified because of that educational requirement. So this was one of the ways in which the 2002 election really privileged the Islamists. In the 2005 election, that was not the case. There were additional requirements that were added to that madrasa degree that would be required to satisfy the BA. The BA requirement. So many people saw this as Musharraf basically trying to send a message to Islamists that you're here because I have created circumstances that are favorable for you to be here, and I can uncreate those favorable circumstances as well.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles. I'm afraid we've run out of time.
Yeah, have a wonderful morning. Enjoy your sunshine.
Thank you very much. Hello again, I'm Ian Master. Just speaking then with Dr. Christine Fair, a senior research associate at the United States Institute of Peace. It's their Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention. She's just returned from Pakistan, where she's a specialist in Indo-Pakistani strategic relations and analyses of the causes of terrorism. This program is produced by Louis Vandenberg, and Jazz Shepherd is the engineer. Rusty Wynn is the associate producer. Carol Coots, the assistant producer.